Jeannie Marazzo, who is Professor of Medicine and Director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And the title of her talk today is Preventing HIV, STI, and Unintended Pregnancy in Women at Risk, Evolving Evidence and Approaches.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to share the podium with two such impassioned speakers. I haven't had the pleasure of sharing one with Claire, but with regard to Dimitri, my feeling always is that if he started a religion, I would return to church. So that's how I feel. So here's what I'm going to say. I'm going to talk about the need very briefly. This is an audience that doesn't need to hear this. I'm going to give you some sense of testing biomedical interventions in women, and I'm going to talk specifically about unanticipated challenges in testing HIV and STI prevention in women, and I'll talk about voice and FemPrep studies very briefly as a paradigm, and then give you some sense of what the evolving evidence is around new products, potential indications, long-acting delivery platforms, and combination prevention. And what we're really going for here is one-stop shopping, right? Maybe not selling guns, wedding gowns, and cold beer, as this Hussey's General Store offers, but something that can really, again, like the New York approach, give you something to just, and like Claire said, just reach behind you, grab it, and use it. We really want to reduce barriers, and that's what this is about. I don't really need to, again, talk to this group about the burden of HIV infection in women. Women, especially in Africa, but also in the South, where I now live, have an incredible burden of HIV infections. And while we're speaking at this conference, I don't really even want to calculate the number of young women who've acquired HIV, particularly in South Africa. I'll talk a little bit about the VOICE study. This is a study that I ran with my colleague Mike Cherenji, and it really illustrated some of the very specific concerns to women and why women don't always have a voice and can't always really necessarily disclose their needs around sexual health. Very different from what's happening in MSM right now, and I think that we need to really have this conversation about what sexual health means for women when it's often very difficult. They're not empowered to necessarily talk about this, particularly with the history of domestic violence, sexual assault. Very different for women, especially young women. So for those of you who don't know about the VOICE study, this was a phase 2 randomized double-blind placebo-controlled 5-arm trial of daily use of several products, or actually 3 products, for prevention of HIV. We screened over 12,000 women in sub-Saharan Africa in 3 countries. We enrolled 5,029. And we asked women to use one of 5 products, vaginal tenofovir gel, oral tenofovir, oral Truvada, vaginal placebo gel, or an oral placebo tablet. And they were asked to use these products daily, just like all the other PrEP studies that were going on at the very same time. And I won't go through them all because you will probably be familiar with them. I always joke about this. I try to fix this slide every time I do this talk, and for some reason the conversion from Mac to PC just won't take it. But you can see this is a Kaplan-Meier analysis curve, and it should be switched, but it doesn't really matter because the lines basically never separate. These are the efficacy data for HIV incidence by treatment arm in the VOICE study, and suffice it to say there was absolutely no difference in any of the arms. And this was in the face of several of the big PrEP trials coming out and saying, wow, including IPREX, including the Partners in Prevention study, including the Botswana TDF2 study, showing really beautiful by adherence performance of PrEP. So clearly PrEP didn't work in our population of young women in sub-Saharan Africa. So what did this mean? Well, first of all, if any of you have run a large study that failed, quote-unquote, dramatically like this, you sort of pick yourself off the ground after going through every brand of gin that you might possibly know. And examine your disappointing results closely. So what the heck happened here? And how can we recover from this and really inform future studies to address this? So this is what makes me crazy when people call this a failed study, because I don't think it was a failed study. We actually got an answer and we moved on it, as I'll talk about. And how can you modify the intervention to address the barriers to success? Why didn't women use these products? I mean, this was in the face of data coming out from the other studies, which we actually informed the women as they were in the study. We actually had to change the consent because IPREX came out. We had to change the consent because Partners in Prevention came out. So what really happened here was that women were not using the products, but they were lying to us throughout participation in the study. So people often say, well, didn't you have some clue that they weren't using the products? Actually, we worked very hard to assess use as we conducted this trial, and we did it in several ways. We had computer-assisted self-interview, we had face-to-face interviews, and we actually had sort of intercurrent, more in-depth interviews with people. And through every single measure, as I'll show you on this slide, people said that they were using the product. So there's a huge disconnect here with their desire to remain in the study and their discomfort with telling us the truth and their distrust in using the products. Clearly, they did not see the products as relevant to their lives. So what you're seeing here is evidence of non-adherence by route of administration and different measures. The different measures shown here, so let's start at the bottom. The CPC is just the clinical presentation where they told people what they were doing. The CPC is the product count. So we brought people their bottles back and counted their pills or their applicators. Face-to-face interview in the ACASI, which is the audio computer assisted self-interview. And you can see, based on all of those things which were done routinely, the rate of noncompliance was very low. Basically, 1 in 10 women weren't really using the product. However, when we asked them about how much time they actually would have said they used the products as very good, you can see a little bit more of a signal there, about 50%. But the real thing where the money hit the road was checking drug levels, and we didn't do those until the end of the study. Why would you check drug levels during the study? I mean, the biostatisticians would have had a heart attack, because you're not supposed to do that because there's potential for unblinding. This was really a radical idea, and it's going to come around in a moment. So when you look at plasma tenofovir levels, whether you look on the swab, whether you look in the plasma, there was huge non-adherence, 69% and 64%. So basically about a third of the women were using products regularly. This is not unique to our study. This is an issue that probably in many prevention studies dealing with healthy people who don't necessarily see themselves as patients, don't necessarily see themselves as vulnerable to the whatever you're trying to prevent, is really a big deal. A nice article in Science a couple years ago talked about these new chips that are being implanted now in biologicals that can actually track whether or not people have taken the study. And then the other thing is, yes, adherence sucked in this study, and that's a problem, but what if women had actually been adherent? Would they have done as well as the men did in IPREX? And unfortunately, here's another example of why women are biologically screwed. So we know that when you look at STD transmission from male to female, it's much more efficient than women to men, right? Unfortunately, it turns out that with the delivery of PrEP, with the delivery of tenofovir-based products, whether you're talking about Truvada or tenofovir, women actually don't get these products to the vulnerable mucosa to the extent that men do, and that's really rectal versus cervicovaginal delivery. So PrEP and MSM, who are going to be exposed at the rectum, is much more forgiving. You can get away with 4 days a week. I tell my patients that, but I still want them to take PrEP every day. But you can get away with 4 days a week based on IPREX data and based on pharmacokinetic models. As Angela Kashuba's group has shown in this very nice paper in JID, and as we all suspect it, it's actually in women at the cervicovaginal mucosa, the delivery of Truvada or tenofovir is about 7 to 11 times lower. So number one, you have to take PrEP longer daily to reach those therapeutic levels to prevent HIV. And number two, you can't really skip doses. You really have to be on it. And even with that, it's probably not as effective at preventing HIV as it is in the rectum. So it's very unfortunate. How do you get around these issues? And what did we learn from the VOICE study and these new sort of data about PK? Well, very similar to LARC. We, again, have to go to ways, I think, that reduce the barriers for women using these products. And a very logical next step would be to looking at a long-acting delivery system for PrEP. And so that's what gave rise to the next big study that just came out, actually this February, led by Jared Baton, Tess Polani-Phillips, and others with the Microbicide Trial Network, using it a vaginal ring with dapivirine, now a non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor, for HIV prevention in women. And this is a multi-center randomized double-blind placebo-controlled phase 3 trial of this ring, which contained 25 milligrams of dapivirine. We don't use dapivirine systemically. It's toxic, so you can only use it as topical, a topical method. And these women were asked to insert the ring once every month and come in for HIV infection. So what did they see? This was a very controversial analysis. Why was it controversial? Because they learned from the VOICE study to monitor adherence during the trial. Huge paradigm shift. So I do feel good about the fact that we did this study and changed the way that things are done. They actually monitored adherence by site. They did not unblind people by their disclosure of adherence, but they did check plasma dapivirine levels. And in the final analysis, they actually excluded two sites with lower adherence. Another thing to give the biostatisticians a stroke, basically. But they did it. Okay? And what did they show? When they did that, this is the intent to treat analysis, just by excluding those two sites with low adherence, they basically found that the protection afforded by the dapivirine ring was about 37%. So you can see in this Kaplan-Meier curve, you do have a significant separation of those two. You'll still see that those HIV prevalence in the placebo group was incredibly high, 12%. And in the voice study, it was about 8%. So this goes to show you what the need is out there. This got even more interesting because people got, again, back to this idea of, okay, clearly 37% is okay, but it's not as good as we would like. Can we look at what really modified this? Who really experienced the most protection? And this set of curves just breaks this down by age group. When you looked at the youngest women, 18 to 21, there was absolutely no protective effect. Wow, pretty amazing. When you looked at women 22 to 26, there was a 56% reduction. Quite a dramatic reduction, right? Thank you. And then when you looked at women at 27 to 45, the older women, there was a 51% reduction. So you see a huge disconnect with the adolescents in this study. Is this all about adherence? Great question, right? Overall, if you look at the effectiveness among women over the 21 years of age, the protection was 56%. I would say that's pretty good, considering that we really don't have any other options in these women with an incidence rate of 12%. So what the ASPIRE data have done is to really revitalize the discussion of antiretroviral delivery by rings. And there are numerous products now under evaluation. There are products that are being studied that have tenofovir in the form of TFV, the unphosphorylated tenofovir. There are those that have TDF, which, as you know, is the product that we give people orally, so probably much more bioactive. And those are two Merck rings that also include Vicrovirac, which is an integrase inhibitor. So very exciting. The combination rings, and one of the things that I'm most exciting about, actually also have hormonal contraception in them. So there are now studies that are including antiretrovirals as well as the hormonal contraceptions that can be used in rings to prevent unintended pregnancy. The issue with this, though, is that not all hormones are the same in these rings. So, for example, the Nuva ring, which we're studying now with regard to its effect on microbiome and HIV shedding, has etanonogesterol. That actually is a proprietary product. So that's not the hormone that is going to be used in these new rings. Most of the new rings are having levonorgestrel. So it's a little bit of a problem because we have a huge history of knowing about the Nuva ring, been used clinically for a long time. We have a lot of data on what the bleeding patterns are and what the opportunities for menstrual suppression are. But for the levonorgestrel, that's really very new. So it's going to be quite interesting to see how this goes. And different components may have varying effects on menstruation in particular. And as I noted here, there are a number of studies looking at this, and some of those are going to be presented actually at the HIV Research for Prevention meeting that's coming up next month in Chicago. Finally, I'll just mention that at the IAS meeting in Durban this past summer, there was more analysis of the ASPIRE studies that was presented by Elizabeth Brown, the biostatistician who was involved in the study. And what Elizabeth did was to develop a new statistical model that was an exploratory analysis of adherence. So we already know that there was that sort of very differential effectiveness by age in ASPIRE, with young women not seeing any benefit. So Elizabeth really went in there and tried to look at what the efficacy was by now looking not only at drug levels in plasma, but also analyzing the rings that were returned. There actually are ways you can look at whether drug actually came out of the ring to estimate whether or not it was used. And drug doesn't come out of the ring unless it's in your body, essentially. And what she found was that in women who had high adherence, basically in which the drug had been absorbed from the ring, the efficacy was 65% versus no protection in those with partial or low adherence. So this is really exciting. There's now a study underway to give the ASPIRE participants the opportunity to continue open label the dapivirine ring, and they're going to look really carefully at factors associated with protection, adherence, and usability. And this is just what some of these sustained release devices look like. You can see the population councils, the international partner for microbicides there, partnership for microbicides, and Conrad's rings there, all with different combinations of antiretrovirals as well as hormones. I should also add that the Pop Council ring has zinc in it, which may have some protection against HSV2 and HPV, and of course the tenofovir-based rings are really expected to have protection against herpes, HSV2. Some very exciting data that are out there. So with that, I will stop, and I didn't realize Claire was going to have a keep calm slide, but I'll just also say that the idea really is to give people choices that fit with their lifestyles and their unique needs, because not everybody's the same. Big surprise. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Jeannie. If anyone has questions for Jeannie, please step up to the mic. We do have some time.
I've got a question around the use of the ring in young women. Are they taking it out during sex in this trial, and what was the coital frequency? Because mm-hmm. that may be obviously a contributing factor to the lack of efficacy.
Yeah, great question. So this question, I think everybody heard the question. There are supporting data to say that women do take the ring out often, and not just for sex. They take it out because they're menstruating. They take it out because they want to wash it. And so some of the qualitative data around attitudes towards ring use is absolutely probably some of the most important, particularly if they're taking it out around menses, which actually can be a time that you're more likely to be exposed to and more vulnerable to viral infections. So that's a really important question. When Elizabeth looked at that in this particular analysis, there wasn't anything that really stood out once you accounted for the pharmacokinetic measures, but I agree we have to really understand that, and the messaging around that has got to be really critical. Great question. Do you want me to bring the other speakers up, or I don't know? Okay.
So as we move more towards methods that are more long-acting for HIV prevention, wondering about how to deal with some of the attitudes that are similar to LARC. There was an article in the May issue of Contraception looking at the attitudes of African American and Latina women towards LARCs, and what their study saw was that they wanted methods, birth control methods that they could take out of their, that they could control taking mm-hmm. out of their body, mm-hmm. that didn't interrupt their menstrual cycle, and that were, you know, not so long acting. So it's mm-hmm. like, how do we deal with, you know, the movement towards more long acting mm-hmm. methods for STD and HIV prevention and birth control that reduce, you know, increase adherence and reduce yeah. user error and are more, you know, effective versus right. the attitudes that people don't necessarily want methods that have these side effects.
Great.
That are
yeah.
more lacking.
Great question. And again, I think it comes back to choice and unique individual needs. I felt like after the VOICE study and also the FAXA-01 study, which showed that pericoital use of tenofovir gel did not protect HIV acquisition, people sort of said, well, clearly women won't use an on-demand product. I actually don't think that's right, because if you do sub-analyses in both of those studies, you can show efficacy for HIV and HSV2 with appropriate gel use. I feel like we have to keep pushing for a spectrum of products that are available, including on-demand products, because not everybody is really going to be a prepared to be protected by virtue of having loaded up either with an oral dose for 7 to 21 days in the case of women, or with ring use that's actually allowed for elaboration of drugs. So some really potent on-demand product I think is not a pipe dream and needs to be really retained on the horizon. I kind of feel like there is a little bit of a tendency for people to say, we figured it out. All we have to do is get this in them and they'll be protected. And that's really arrogant and doesn't really recognize the reality of, again, what women are facing on a day-to-day basis, both in terms of their desires and their sometimes inability to control what happens to them sexually. You know, that's the other huge elephant in the room that people don't really talk about. It's sort of like, if we just design the perfect product, then they'll be fine, which is just, I think, not very thoughtful. Yes?
Hi, Robert Herrick, Sarah County Health in California. And this is a question, actually, for all three speakers. We've discussed both with contraceptives with PrEP, both the opportunities for STI screening and treatment and HIV prevention, but no one has addressed the perception that with both oral contraceptives, long-acting contraceptives, PrEP, that the only sexual consequence I have to care about is prevented. So with predominantly heterosexual couples, it's unplanned pregnancy. With MSM, it's HIV. And so the perception with both products is, I don't need to worry about any other STIs. I don't need to worry about using condoms because the only major consequence is prevented. How do we address that perception so that we can sort of get the other consequences, which are honestly, in many cases, quite devastating, on people's radar going, oh, okay, I'm not perfectly safe just taking this one product?
Right. Great question. And maybe Dimitri and Claire want to come up and comment on that. I would get back to Dimitri's excellent point. We don't have time. We're done. I would not to speak for all the other panelists, but I would get back to the point that these methods need to be delivered in a comprehensive sexual health approach. I mean, you can't just say that this is about HIV prevention. This is about keeping you healthy and increasing your choices and increasing your opportunities to address your sexual and reproductive health needs. I agree. I mean, it's a very new tack for us because we're very pathogen sort of focused and specific, and we just need to break that mold. And I'll stop there because I think we're done. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of our great speakers today.